Mistrust in government, its roots and impact on our society. Where is the line between what might be considered a healthy dose of skepticism and a dangerous belief system? Well, that's one of the big questions of our times, and it manifests itself in many corners of our society. Think politics, religion, education, and healthcare. I'm Jennifer Rooks. On Maine Calling today, we are kicking off a series of programs looking at this question of mistrust and misinformation in society. Today, we start with mistrust of government. University of Maine professor Amy Freed is the co-author of a new book arguing that Republicans have spent the past half century strategically weaponizing mistrust for their advantage. We'll discuss this idea with her and with conservative political scientist Norm Ornstein. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Is mistrust in government healthy or corrosive? Has it been strategically manipulated? In a new book, University of Maine political science professor Amy Freed argues that for the past half century, one political party in particular has sowed the seeds of distrust of government to their advantage. The title of her book is At War with Government: How Conservatives Weaponized Distrust from Goldwater to Trump. And she joins us for the hour today. Also with us, Norman Ornstein. He is emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor for The Atlantic, and author of numerous books, including It's Even Worse Than It Looks: How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. We invite you to join our conversation. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, find us on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And I'd like to note that this is going to be the first of several programs over the next few months on this concept of mistrust in our society. We're going to discuss mistrust with experts from different areas of scholarship. And today we are talking about politics. Amy Freed, Norm Ornstein, welcome to Maine Calling.
It's great to be here, Jennifer.
Amy, I'll start with you. You know, mistrust in government is really in the DNA of the American people. After all, it was mistrust of King George that founded our nation, wasn't it? But you argue that something changed with the candidacy of Barry Goldwater in 1968, that mistrust became a strategy for Republicans. Explain that. What changed from the mistrust in government that had been prior to then to something that was going to change fundamentally for that party?
Thanks, Jennifer, for having me here. And yes, this book, which I wrote with a colleague, Doug Harris of Loyola University, Maryland, looks back to the early Republican in some ways and says, yes, we've always had a certain amount of mistrust in government. And in fact, some of that is very healthy to have skepticism towards those in political power. However, what we look at is the shift in which distrust gets used strategically in four different ways. One is to build and maintain organizations as kind of a fundamental organizing principle. Another to wage elections, make electoral appeals. Also, as part of institutional battles, let's say between Congress and presidential power, to try to pull power away from institutions that one doesn't control and push it towards one that they do. And then also as part of policy battles, and we talk a lot about healthcare, although it certainly applies to other areas. And I think there are a lot of things that happen in that period politically. In the mid-1960s into the 1970s, there's the civil rights movement, there's tax revolts, there's changes in the configuration of the different party coalitions where involving race often. And there's also the greater use of public opinion technologies by Congress and by political parties, even though they had been used, you know, back even Franklin Roosevelt used polling, but they start being used more. And so it becomes this, you know, really the strategic weapon to try to promote distrust in government.
So you think really it's not Barry Goldwater himself, but the growth of public opinion polling in the late 1960s that was sort of the turning point, and where instead of it being just part of the American public personality, it becomes something that we say, the Republicans said, we can use this as a strategy.
That's certainly part of it. Yeah, having these kind of what we call public opinion technologies more in use and more available, and other things that are shifting in the larger political context. And even though, yes, certainly Goldwater, we talk about Goldwater, we talk about Reagan, I think a big turning point, and I see this in some of Norm's writings as well, is Newt Gingrich, you know, during the Clinton years, where there's really this very, you know, he's a very strategic individual, the former Speaker of the House, Gingrich. And when he's in the minority, you know, when Republicans are in the minority in the House, part of his strategy to win is to develop all of this language calling Democrats corrupt and anti-family and evil, and, you know, just mount this whole series of efforts to which are really fundamentally rooted in distrust to try to gain power, which success, you know, it was successful.
So Norm Ornstein, turning to you, in the late 1960s and then building through the 1970s, do you agree? Do you believe that you are a Republican? Do you believe that Republicans turned and instead of saying, okay, we believe in small government, that there was a recognition that people believe that government was not just best small, but instead not good at all, but instead evil, and that it was a strategic move to capitalize on this belief?
Well, first, Jennifer, thanks also for having me, but I'm not a Republican. So I'll put that, but let me put that to the side. First, Amy is exactly right. I want to put this into an even larger historical context, though. Because there's a part of this that is not new at all, even going back to 1964 and Goldwater. Goldwater was the culmination of a long process of a populist, virulently anti-government move within the Republican Party to take it over. You can go back to the 1930s, but certainly in the 1940s, Robert Taft of Ohio led this movement and was fended off by Wendell Willkie and then by Thomas Dewey, known as the Country Club Republicans as opposed to the Main Street Republicans. But there's an even longer historical thread here, and that is the role of race in our country, which goes back right to the beginning. And the undercurrents of racism and the racial threads go all the way through this. They're not all surrounding the Republican Party. Most of them, all the way up, I would say almost through the 1950s, were and into the 1960s, were more about the Democratic Party, which had the segregationist, racist core to it. You go to the 1950s, Dwight Eisenhower actually had support from a near majority of African Americans in the country, admittedly, a lot of them who couldn't vote at that time. Goldwater changed that. Richard Nixon, who succeeded him running on his law and order platform, changed that. All of that moves forward. And then you have Newt Gingrich, and not just Newt Gingrich, but the rise in the 1980s of first talk radio, but then the larger sense of tribal media. And race, you cannot separate out from a lot of this. Newt very deliberately tribalized our politics. And that's a word that, you know, is a controversial one, but it's the only one I can come up with. You know, when you have polarization, which we've clearly had and it's been growing, you can still work together and find ways to work together. Maine has had many senators in the past, like Margaret Chase Smith and Olympia Snow, and independents and Democrats even now, like Angus King, who have found ways to work across the lines. And it's, you know, you're misguided. You have beliefs that are wrongheaded, but there are common problems. We can find common ground, and then we can do some horse trading. Tribalizing politics means that you look at people on the other side as evil, trying to destroy your way of life. Working with them means that it's almost like sleeping with the enemy. And that meant a rise of a new kind of populism in the Republican Party, and it's been there in both parties and in the middle as well, that instead of receding as it normally does when the economy gets better, has only been intensified in recent years. And what Newt did was to succeed in this tribalization. And now what we know is, one, the electorate is driven by negative partisanship. It's far more the motivation of sticking it to the other side or keeping them from winning victories. And just as an aside, you look at what's happened with vaccination and masking, and that's all a part of the same phenomenon. We're not going to mask or get vaccinated or allow anything to happen, even though we've allowed vaccine mandates for every other disease or ailment, because to do so would give aid and comfort to the enemy. Donald Trump was a culmination, not the beginning or the, he was an accelerant of all of this. But I would throw in another word now too, which is cult. And that is the Republican Party, which struggled with these different elements, was still a party and a problem-solving party. And it's now become almost like a fanatic religious cult. And that leaves us in a very bad place, because problem-solving is not a part of it. And ideology is replaced by theology. And all of that is not easy to deal with or ameliorate.
Oh boy, a lot there. Amy, yeah. And some of what you said, Norm Ornstein, reminds me, Amy, of something I read in your book, and you're talking about tying in this idea of mistrust with race. And Amy, you make this point that it's not just mistrust of government, but building this narrative of mistrust of groups other than your own group. And to the point of you make the point that Goldwater's candidacy, 6% of the African American vote compared to 32% of the African-American vote for Nixon and 39% for Eisenhower. So the same point that Norm Ornstein is making right there, that indeed was a turning point. Amy, you talk about this point for in fact, the subhead of your book is how conservatives weaponized distrust from Goldwater to Trump. So to Norm Ornstein's point that Trump is a culmination, Do you argue, though, Amy, that Trump was what Republican Party was setting out to do through Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, et cetera?
Well, I'd say yes and no. I mean, I think Trump is definitely more extreme in his rhetoric, more disdainful of democratic norms. You see the attacks on election and election officials. More overtly racist and xenophobic in language, attacks parts of the government that, you know, other Republicans didn't attack, like the FBI, you know, quote, deep state, et cetera. So there are some differences. But it is, you know, again, a part of the same dynamic. It's part of the same, you know, broader dynamic, but in a more extreme way. And, you know, even though we have a whole chapter on Reagan, and certainly Reagan used a lot of anti-government rhetoric, he had been a governor and he cared about governing and he knew something about it. He knew how to do it. So he had, you know, more of a mixed view when it came to using government to do things. And in fact, at one point even expanded healthcare in a way that then got changed in the next administration. You know, the catastrophic health coverage, it had its own issues with the way it was set up. But he, you know, so it's, and I would also say that there's something that's been going on that some of the established Republicans are not really that happy about, and in any every generation, as Norm has pointed out, you know, going way back, there are establishment Republicans that don't like this certain turn. And in the very first paper that Doug Harris and I did on this topic, on the use of distrust strategically, we had a little epigraph from Hemingway, him talking about bullfighting. And, you know, where Hemingway would said that you have the matador holding this red cape to get the bull to kind of charge, you know, so that when it would charge, you would, you know, hit it with your, you know, whatever the matador has, to the little different spears. But that sometimes the bull will turn and hit the matador. And gore the matador, and that's kind of that metaphor that, you know, we're using it as a metaphor where you have conservative elites, Republican elites, who try to rile up the public with distrust in various ways, but sometimes it turns against them. So you had all of these you had some establishment Republicans during the Tea Party era who lost their primaries. You're seeing those issues right now as well with Trump saying, no, don't vote for this more establishment person, vote for the Trump candidate, you know? And so, you know, even though it is, yes, in some ways a culmination of what we see along the way, there have often been times where the base that gets excited by this goes too far as some of the Republican establishment. They're not happy with how it's going. They would rather be more like, let's govern, let's accomplish some things. But it becomes almost an impossible trap to get out of, because you can lose your primary, you can get drummed out of the party if you raise too many questions along the way.
Norm Ornstein, is it only Republicans who use distrust to their political advantage?
No, certainly. Parties play hardball, and it's not like there are angels here as opposed to devils, but this is largely asymmetric at the moment. And in a larger sense, one thing we can't ignore here is the role of social media now as an amplification of a lot of this, and that's creating this ground for conspiracy theories, but that also, to amplify Amy's point, cows establishment politicians. The combination of tribal media riling up a base, of social media that can take pernicious messages and make them even more acceptable, creates a toxic climate. So now, I'm not going to give a pass to establishment figures who feel like they have no choice. There's no moral character here anymore. Right now, what we have is a group of politicians who ought to be saying, we have a larger crisis here with the Delta variant and very possibly the next variants to come. We have to put public health first, and we have to have masks and vaccines. And instead, they're going in the opposite direction to mollify conspiracy theorists. Look at Ron DeSantis standing there at a platform yesterday while somebody who had joined with him to speak out against vaccination and mask mandates said the vaccine takes over and destroys your RNA. And what does he say? Nothing. That's monstrous in my view. And you can have hardball politics or even dirty politics at some level. You know, I've been around for many decades, and I'm used to a lot of that. What I'm seeing now goes way beyond that, and it's appalling. And there's no doubt, as Amy said, that you have politicians who tried to exploit the anger and distrust in the electorate. Certainly, if you go back to the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, we had these Republican leaders in the House who called themselves the Young Guns, put out a book with a picture on the cover that was taken from the movie. And that was Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, and the current Republican House leader, Kevin McCarthy, and they went around the country and fanned the flames of anger of that Tea Party movement, believing they could co-opt it, and they have been co-opted. But now they've let these pernicious forces take over in a really bad way. And nobody, or at least very few figures, a Liz Cheney, a Mitt Romney at times, an Adam Kinzinger, are standing up and saying, we can't go along with this anymore. But they're left isolated and alone. And it's a really, really dangerous period for this country.
All right. Well, I want to talk about what we can do about this. These seeds of mistrust that seem to have taken such strong root, but we do need to take a break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Lunder Foundation in support of the Colby College Museum of Art. We're bringing the museum to you online at colby.edu/museum. And by Machias Savings Bank, committed to helping customers find their yes as part of a mission to move Maine forward. MachiasSavings.bank.
On the next Speaking in Maine, Hungry to Learn.
This is students who are literally unable to afford their tuition, their books, and also to eat regularly.
Join us for a conversation between Phil Lader, former U.S. Ambassador to the Court of St. James, and Soledad O'Brien, documentarian, journalist, and author. This is the fourth episode of our series featuring this year's Summer Institute at College of the Atlantic.
Thinking about donating your used vehicle to Maine Public? Well, now is a great time, especially if you plan to replace it. When you donate a vehicle to Maine Public during the months of September and October, our friends at Lee Auto Malls will provide you with a $500 Lee Thank You Reward for use toward the purchase of a new or used vehicle at any Lee Auto Malls 19 locations throughout Maine. For complete details, please visit mainepublic.org. And thank you, as donated cars, trucks, and SUVs make it possible for us to do more here at your public radio station.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about the roots of mistrust in the government. Joining me, Amy Freed, who is professor of political science at the University of Maine and co-author of the new book, At War with Government. Also with us, Norman Ornstein, who is emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and contributing editor for The Atlantic. Share your comments or questions via a short email. talk@mainepublic.org is the email address. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go up to Caribou and June. Hi, June. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I think to solve some of these problems, we have for the first time in human history the technology to watch the government instead of the government watching us. Total and complete surveillance and transparency of government and privacy for the people, because the scourge of governments has plagued the earth ever since humanity left small direct tribal living. And we have these tools for the first time in human history, but they're in the wrong hands now. They're in the hands of governments. And the very tools that are in China, the foundation of its surveillance infrastructure, the tools that have just destroyed Hong Kong's democracy, the greatest surveillance state in human history, is now being erected around the world, including the United States. And Hong Kong's democracy activists realize this too late. This data collection is not for us, it's data about us, and the end of freedom comes with the end of privacy. And so I just wanted, you know, to end corruption and all of these things. It's really about taking these tools that humanity has developed together and using it for human freedom to end the tyranny of corrupt governments. But I've heard this on Amon Poor and Company, the beautiful book Surveillance Capitalism. They are warning that if we don't act quickly on this and focus on the right things and have the media focus on this, that there will come a time where it's too late, because the infrastructure and the tools of technology of oppression are so strong now that people in Hong Kong, there's no way out, because it's the surveillance infrastructure is everywhere. And it's being erected here in the United States as well. And I just please recommend everyone listening to read the book Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff out of Harvard. Thank you.
June, thank you. And Shoshana has been a guest on Maine Calling. Amy, I want to turn to you, and this reminds me of something that you have, one of the things you posit in your book and you mention is that even those who espouse small government also really espouse the growth of government in other places. They may say that they want fewer benefits in one area, but then also, for example, want there to be more police protection.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talk about that with Reagan, for example, who, you know, at the very same press conference that he starts out by saying, you know, the nine most dangerous words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. You know, those are the most scary words. He then went on to talk about the need to support farmers in the Midwest more and increase support for them. But regarding your caller's question, I would say, you know, there absolutely must be some kind of balance. Yes, we don't want government to get to be too powerful. No one should, you know, think that is in any way what I'm arguing, you know. And but on the other hand, to accomplish things as a people, to have some things that are social goods, you need to have government to do that. And so what is the correct balance there is really the question. And also, if we're going to control social media companies, that can only be done through public means. You know, that's one of the purposes of government, is to control private power when it gets to be too powerful. Now, not to control private life altogether. You know, we need to have entrepreneurship and businesses and people living in freedom and all of that. But you also don't want different kinds of private power to become too powerful. We had this whole anti-monopoly movement starting in the 19th century because of that, you know, against railroads and the like. And you know, so there's a balance there. To have a nation with freedom requires a certain amount of activity by government, whether that's to, you know, have enough education for people so that they can thrive. You know, you cannot have opportunity if there aren't some social services and, you know, some infrastructure, for example.
Norm.
There's a lot to unpack in the caller's comments. One part of this is that it isn't just government, of course, it is social media companies. And what Americans have done, what's happened in a lot of places around the world, although more here than in other places, is the convenience that comes with all that we can do with social media, with using e-commerce and the like. Nobody reads the statements and the contracts that we sign, but we've sacrificed an enormous amount of our freedom. And that's going to come back to bite us at some point. And certainly at one level, as Amy said, government has to provide some boundaries and some guidelines. That's much harder to do now in this tribal environment, because what Republicans want to do with social media companies is to crack down on those who have limited, they say, the speech of Donald Trump. And a lot of what we see with these conspiracy theories and the misinformation and disinformation. At the same time, there's no doubt that government is able to use these tools for surveillance. But let's also keep in mind that what cell phone cameras, for example, and the internet have done, going back to Tiananmen Square, is to enable the world to see oppression and government behavior that is inhuman and beyond the pale. It's because of cell phone cameras that now we're finally starting to see what police have done to people of color, that in the past, we would only hear one side of a story. He had a gun, he had a knife planted on him, he resisted arrest. where we're seeing now many instances where it's something different and we're getting a little bit of a balance in terms of justice. But the tools that can be used for good can be used for evil. And I would just make one final comment, which is, I don't think what's happened to the people of Hong Kong is simply because government has the tools of surveillance. It's brute force. And if they had none of those tools, going in, cracking down on demonstrations, arresting all of the pro-democracy people, with the rest of the world shrugging its shoulders. What we see happening with the Rohingya in Malaysia, what we've seen with the Uyghurs in China, that's not because of surveillance. It's because of brutal governments and no pushback from the rest of the world.
June, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Joe, who's calling from the Casco Bay Bridge. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi,
Joe,
there.
Are you
thanks
there? Yeah, go
me
ahead.
On. Thanks for having this very important and pertinent discussion. Was something that the guests talked about earlier about the long history of sowing mistrust and so forth struck me when they were speaking about Donald Trump. And it seems to me, I don't know the history of Barry Goldwater and the rest, but it seems to me there's a little bit of a difference, maybe a major difference here, with Donald Trump in that he seems to be working for his own self-interest more than, say, any other. And I wondered if the and that's certainly very troubling and concerning, but he seems to drive division and mistrust for that gain. And so I wondered if the guests could comment on that, and I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
And Norm Ornstein.
Well, of course, he's absolutely right. And, I've a couple of thoughts that I've had. One, people ask me all the time, will Trump really run again in 2024? And my answer is, I'm skeptical that in the end he will run, but he will say he's going to run. And there are two reasons for that. One is it cows the other aspirants to the Republican nomination. But the main reason is he can raise a ton of money. And the way our campaign finance laws work, the money that you raise, you can spend on almost anything, and he'll use it for his own personal expenses. This is somebody who used his position as president to make a large sum of money. He's the first president who didn't divest himself or really get distance from his own financial interests. He manipulated his hotel in Washington illegally with a lease from the government, which the terms of the lease spelled out directly that he wasn't supposed to have it, and then raised the prices as foreign governments and others intervened. He doubled the initiation fee at Mar-a-Lago to $200,000 and basically let foreign nationals like the Chinese and others, if they were willing to pay the $200,000, come in and listen to his conversations around the table, which included classified stuff. There are so many examples of a president as a kleptocrat. Now, there's also a long tradition of autocrats exploiting their positions to make money for themselves and their families. Erdogan in Turkey, Putin in Russia, Sisi and Mubarak in Egypt. What we just saw with Ghani leaving Afghanistan with a large amount of American money, very likely. We didn't expect to see it here in the United States, but we have had it with Trump. And it's a part of also what we see with the cult, that people who unite behind a cult leader just ignore all of the horrific failings that that leader might have if they think that he is anointed to be the leader. We had on Turner Classic Movies just last week, yet another showing of a movie that I told people to watch as Trump emerged in 2015. It's Elia Kazan's movie, A Face in the Crowd, and with a stunning performance by Andy Griffith of a dissolute alcoholic taken out of a jail who becomes a folk hero, has his own radio show, And is skyrocketing towards a presidential nomination, and the people who've been close to him realizing that he is a megalomaniac and finally bringing him down with his own words. That worked. His own words disdaining his own followers, which they told him that the microphone had been turned off when it had not, destroyed him. But Trump's words, including calling veterans and those who died in combat losers worse, are ignored. So it's not an entirely perfect analogy, but that's what we've been stuck with.
Well, we do need to take another quick break. We're talking about mistrust of government. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Eastern Basements, a division of Maine-owned Eastern Mold Remediation, offering crawl space repairs and waterproofing, easternbasements.com, and by Dean Sweets in Portland, specializing in hand-dipped truffles, caramels, buttercreams, and other seasonal chocolates. DeanSweets.com.
I'm Scott Tong. Have you looked at the fine print of your house's deed? Well, some of them have what's called a racial covenant.
It declared that no one outside of European descent or outside of the white race could buy, rent, or occupy the land.
Removing racial covenants, that's next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us Here and Now, upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is a media sponsor of the Camden International Film Festival, happening September 16th to 19th in person and September 16th to 26th online. Now in its 17th year of documentary film programming in Mid-Coast Maine, this year's festival includes 37 feature films and 33 short films representing more than 30 countries. For details on the Camden International Film Festival, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. How has the government lost the trust of so many Americans? My guest today, Norm Ornstein, who is Emeritus Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and Amy Fried, Professor of Political Science at the University of Maine and the author of the new book, At War with Government, How Conservatives Weaponized Distrust from Goldwater to Trump. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to Facebook or Instagram. A couple people pushing back a little bit at this conversation. Kim on Facebook writes, targeting Republicans with this topic is not fair. Both are at fault, and until we discuss it on both sides, there will be no end to it. And from Bill, please ask your guests on how they account for the equally brutal attacks on trust from the Democrats. Amy Fried.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that certainly you do get some of that from the left. You know, you can't cover absolutely everything in one book. But I would also push back a little bit in that I don't think that we see the same thing from Democratic leaders. And that's really what this book is about. I mean, I was thinking about how now, there's this tendency among a lot of, you know, a certain number of Republicans to just dismiss any election, or upcoming election, saying there's going to be fraud. Larry Elder, who's a candidate for governor in California, should Gavin Newsom be recalled, he probably would, you know, become governor, already has a website saying we need to investigate the fraud. And that there's some statistical analysis that there's fraud in that election. I mean, the election hasn't even been completed yet. So how could there be a statistical analysis of fraud in the election? I mean, it's just absurd. So I don't think there's the same use of distrust from leaders, from Democratic leaders, and in this weaponization of it. Although you do see some of these things in the, you know, amongst voters, you know, absolutely. I had people who used to tell me all the time that George W. Bush had stolen the 2004 election, and why wasn't I like looking into that, you know? And I didn't think they're really, you know, but you didn't really see that as a concerted effort from Democratic leaders, and certainly not from the Democratic presidential candidate in 2004, John Kerry. So, you know, I think that's what the difference, or that's one of the big differences. And that kind of unevenness between the parties is what Norm Ornstein and his co-author Tom Mann call asymmetric polarization, that, yeah, there's definitely polarization. And you see all kinds of things from Democrats and from Republicans, but you also have certain ways in which the Republican Party is different.
Norm Ornstein, do you agree?
I do. And, you know, just to point out a few things. And again, it's not like we're looking at one side that's all angelic and the other that's all evil. But right now, 60% or more of Republicans believe that Joe Biden is not a legitimate president. Two-thirds of the House Republicans, after a violent insurrection against the Capitol, voted the same way. We know that many of those members of Congress, including Paul Gosar, Mo Brooks, and others, actively worked with the leaders of the insurrection to bring it about. We know that Donald Trump encouraged it on that day. We know that that the Republicans in the Senate voted to filibuster and kill an attempt to look at the origins of and the realities behind the violent insurrection on January 6th that had been agreed to by the leaders of both parties in the House, and that gave an equal role for Republicans because they didn't even want to look into it. We know that Madison Cawthorn, a Republican member of the House, has called for yet another violent insurrection, that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and others have made inflammatory statements. And there are many others that are that just have very few equivalents, shall we say, on the other side. So we're in a different world now. 30% of Republicans in surveys done by the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago say that violence is appropriate if people believe that their way of life is being threatened. That is not something we see in equivalent amounts on both sides. And it is, one would hope, and it's important to say here, this country needs two vibrant political parties. They need two parties that will be focused on working together to solve problems for the country. The Republican Party that would be that party is going to be a very conservative party. It's going to be a whole lot closer to Liz Cheney than to Olympia Snow or Susan Collins. But we don't have that party right now. And that Liz Cheney, who is as conservative as anybody I have come across, is a pariah in the party. And Madison Cawthorn and Josh Hawley are not. That the leading figures among the governors are all promoting basically disobedience against an attempt to rein in a pandemic and are being lauded for it, is just not something that we see on the other side. So, you know, we have to be hard-headed and pragmatic and realistic about this. And to say that it's both sides equally, it just doesn't fit reality.
We'll go to Ryan, who's calling from Orono. Hi, Ryan, go ahead.
Hi, I was listening to you guys talk about the mistrust of government, and it made me think, I'm a student over at the University of Maine, and I've had the pleasure of taking a lot of classes with Dr. Ann Knowles, who is a Holocaust historian. And in many of these classes, we talked about how nationalist leaders use this sort of tinderbox effect, these pre-existing conditions and unoriginal ideas, in order to inflame the issues that the working class already has with their leadership in order to frame themselves as sort of a hero. And I'm seeing a lot of similarities between modern conservative leaders using these sort of tactics in order to inflame people from, you know, rural areas like Maine into believing that the government is out to get them, wherein they are also representatives of the government. And I was just hoping that you guys could speak on that a little.
Amy Fried.
What I'd say is, you know, yes, indeed, there can be a lot of danger. I mean, I look at January 6th. And what I see is an incredible amount of luck that it was not worse. You know, you see the the video of the Capitol policeman who drew away a whole mob away from going into one of the chambers. You see the video of Mitt Romney running the other direction when he's warned to. I mean, we really could have come close. We really not come close. We did come close to something very, very bad, much worse happening, which and that would have been, you know, finding Nancy Pelosi, killing her, finding Vice President Pence and killing him, killing senators, killing House members. Where would we be in that circumstance? I mean, I think we came very close, really, to losing our republic. And it, you know, I think it's just incredible, the situation. And, you know, there's a group that's planning a demonstration very soon. I believe it's, I don't know, the 18th, something
Saturday,
like that.
Yeah.
Saturday. Yeah. Who say that the January 6th defendants are political prisoners and it's, you know, they shouldn't be prosecuted. So, I mean, the amount of looking away at the violence that occurred and how close we came, it is really quite stupendous. And, you know, Senator Collins did avoid a formal censure from the main Republican Party, but she did have a letter written to her saying that they were, that they, you know, from the party at one point, that, and then certain county party organizations that calling her out because they didn't like that she had voted for the second impeachment, you know, and also that she had voted to certify the election. And, you know, like there is a certain element there that is highly problematic when it comes to just supporting democratic norms. And if you don't support democratic norms, you can fall into supporting violence, you know, as the alternative. You know, people say that, you know, I mean, you politics is war by other means, right? So we make political decisions in a nonviolent way through our political mechanisms. But if those are completely illegitimate, and that's really where I'm worried, it's not just, you know, regular distrust, but going into this state where it's just completely illegitimate, then violence becomes an acceptable alternative. And that is so bad, so dangerous.
Well, you know, Ryan, thanks for your call. And that's what I want to go next to, both Norm and first you, Norm, and then Amy. In the time we have left, what do we do with this information? I think many people are fearful that this mistrust turns into something even more menacing. What do you advise?
So first, we really need to give support to the congressional committee that's investigating January 6th and make sure we leave no stone unturned. I was at the first presidential debate in Cleveland in 2020 when President Trump referred to the Proud Boys, which is a violent white supremacist group that was very active on January 6th. And said, gave a message to them, stand by and stand up, which was a pretty clear message. We need to get to the bottom of the conversations and communications that took place. And then we have to make sure that all of those who were leaders are held accountable. That's one part of it. A second part of it is we're gonna have to find a way through this pandemic, because the next wave of violence is gonna occur, I think, less in Washington, D.C., where I am, than at places around the country. And I fear for school boards and healthcare workers, because we're seeing leaders in the Republican Party basically saying if they try to enforce vaccine mandates or mask mandates, you know what to do. And if we get violence of that sort, we need to make sure that those who help to incite it are held accountable. In a larger sense, obviously, we've got a lot of repair work to do to move away from this kind of tribal identity. There are structural changes that could help, but it's a cultural problem. We need the structures to change so that, and that includes protecting our elections with an impressive new bill that Senator Manchin has supported that's out today. But we've got a lot more to do to try and bring people together and move us away from this sense that half the country is evil and trying to destroy us.
And Amy, you talk in your book about the idea of having a common purpose.
Absolutely. You know, I think rebuilding that sense of national identity, common identity, that we're going to work on problems together. There's a whole series of different potential solutions in our chapter 7, which I tried, you know, we try very hard to be evidence-based, like let's look at what research shows actually works. And I think there's going to be a lot of different things that'll be necessary, some much more longer term in civic education, trying to rebuild certain kinds of civic virtues, one called democratic forbearance, which is the willingness to, you know, sort of hold back sometimes, not get so extreme in your responses, just like you don't always have to get mad at something your spouse says. You can just sort of roll your eyes internally. But you hold back a little bit, trying to teach those sorts of things. But I mean, that's a very long-term thing. I think also looking at how we behave with each other in local politics and state politics, which perhaps we have a bit more control over, how we speak to each other, reaching out to our fellow citizens, which, you know, Maine politicians do quite a lot as they run for office, going door to door and talking to people, letting people know what's going on. I think that makes a difference, rebuilding local political organizations if they've fallen into some sort of disarray. That can be very helpful as well. Explaining to people the realities of what different government programs are doing, trying to structure them in ways that works better, and talking about that this is something that's helpful to people, so that they have those experiences and, you know, in their lives, and they can recognize them as something that government's doing. I mean, there are a whole series of things, but yeah, indeed, it comes back to having this proper balance between skepticism towards government, needing accountability from government, and needing transparency from government, but also the willingness to work with others and towards our common purposes.
Well, I really thank both of you for joining us for this hour. The voice you just heard, Amy Fried, a professor of political science at the University of Maine and co-author of the new book, At War with Government, How Conservatives Weaponized Distrust from Goldwater to Trump. And also with us today, Norman Ornstein, emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Today's sound engineer was George Thomas, and Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Reviving Lost Languages, How Wabanaki Languages Are Being Preserved and Taught. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.